home and in the school. And we feel that there is no more important job that can be done in this country today than the development of good, positive intergroup relations. This conference, we hope, will draw us a little closer to an understanding of the modern methods and techniques that are used to help us achieve this goal. Our school is founded on the principles of good intergroup relations between peoples, and it is a living and working part of our school every day. We're very proud of this conference, as I said before, and there have been many people involved. I don't know if credit can possibly be given to all of them, but you will hear more about that a little later. But the one man whose efforts and energy have brought this about is our next speaker, our director, Norman Studer.
When our school was founded in 1944, it was founded as part of a tremendous idealistic movement. It was a time when people in this country and all over the world had high hopes for the spread of democracy. As I say, the school was founded at that time. We were part of that wave of the future. Since then, things have changed. The wave has somewhat subsided. For instance, at that time, our Board of Education here in New York City had courses in intercultural education. All of that was stopped. There has been a great deal of talk of intercultural education here and there, but not the concentrated efforts, the lectures, the courses, the enthusiastic embracing of this important new movement. And sometimes one feels, though, one's talking to oneself in this whole question. Not that the problems haven't been as acute, not that we haven't had the existence of prejudice or that the need for such a thing has disappeared, but I think it had something to do with the temper of the times. I think that at this point, we're beginning to have more courage. We're beginning to feel that we can change attitudes and change the world. And we started this idea of an intergroup conference last year with the thought that we would make this an annual affair. And in a sense, we hope that we will make at least some small contribution to a growing movement for intergroup or intercultural education. And the thing that was the cause of our founding, we will in turn keep it alive. We are concerned here. This is one of our current problems. We're concerned with every aspect of education, and each year we take some time to get a perspective on what we're doing. So this is not something that we go out of our way to do. And since we are doing it, we feel that we would like to talk to other people in the city who are doing the same thing, other people who have problems, so we and they can benefit by this interchange. Tomorrow, our conference begins at 1 o'clock. We have a number of speakers, some workshops where we can sit down in small groups and exchange our experiences and bring our problems, and we hope that all of you who are here tonight will come back tomorrow. As I say, this conference is larger than the school itself, and we've had a committee of teachers and parents and former parents working with us on this conference. We've also had people from outside of the school, and I'd like to mention several people who worked very faithfully with us. One, I'm sure, is here this evening. I'll mention him first. Mr. Barry Keating of the Center for Human Relations in New York University. He is here this evening. Two other members of our committee outside the school, Mrs. Zyra Lowry of Brooklyn Community Woodward School, and Miss Ellen O'Leary, director of the Emerson School. Our question this evening is a question of integration and the preparation for integration, which will give our conference a nationwide perspective. I'd like to look on this meeting this evening in another way. Later on this evening, we are giving an award for an outstanding children's book of 1957. I'd like to consider at this point that we are, in a sense, by our presence here and by our invitation to our speaker, we are giving an award for courage in education. We are giving a war, we're paying tribute to someone who has dignified this profession of teaching in a way in which makes us feel very proud. We talk a great deal about the recognition given to the educators, and rather the lack of recognition given to educators, and we at least would like at this point to give our public recognition as parents and teachers and people generally here in the city to an educator who displayed extraordinary courage under very trying circumstances. I'm sure that you know that I'm talking now about the former principal of the high school in Clinton, Tennessee, Mr. David Britton.
Thank you, Mr. Studer, Mr. Brown, and Mrs. Noble, parents and teachers of the Downtown Community School of New York. I hope that you people are going to be able to understand my accent. If not, just raise your hand and I will try to repeat myself in different words. I'm here tonight to share with you a few of the experiences of last year in Clinton High School. I would like to say in the beginning that some of these things will be rather personal. I do not bring these personal elements in because they relate to me as an individual, but I know of no other way to explain them so that you can understand what really took place. I feel very humble in appearing before a group such as this. You have been working on this problem of intercultural relationships since 1944, I believe. And our baptism of fire was in 1956 and 57. To understand what occurred in Clinton, Tennessee, it might be well if you had a little picture of the community itself. It is a small rural community of about 5,000 people located in the hills of East Tennessee. It is situated 6 miles from Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where the atomic bomb was developed, at least part of it. 16 miles from Knoxville and 6 miles from Norwalk. We're in the foothills of the Great Smoky Mountains. Our population is mainly native white, with a small Negro population of approximately 300 families out of 30,000 people in Anderson County. There were actually only 12 Negro students in the entire community who were eligible to attend Clinton High School. To give you a little background, in 1950, the first three Negro students walked into my office and applied for admission to Clinton High School. I had no warning that this was to occur, and I'll tell you quite frankly, it was a shock to me. Because at this particular time, there was a law in Tennessee which stated that Negro and white students could not go to school together. I explained this to these students and told them that we could not accept them. A few months later, we were taken into court on this, and there were a series of court proceedings which culminated in the famous Supreme Court decision of 1954, which invalidated the previous decisions of separate but equal facilities for Negro and white students, which was actually not true. They were separate, but they were not equal in any matter of the term. In 1950, when we were faced with this problem, some of us could foresee that eventually we would integrate Clinton High School. So we started at that particular time in working towards the integration, which was to occur some 6 years later. We felt that our sole hope for survival was for the people to fully understand what was to take place, what was involved in it, and let them freely discuss it among themselves, particularly these some 800 students within our school. These students were high school students, 9th grade through 12. And so, beginning in 1950 and carrying right up to the actual date of integration, we encouraged our children to discuss this matter freely and openly in class. They debated it. They wrote themes about it. They had panel discussions. We invited speakers in. We had exchange programs with the Negro school. There was a Negro elementary school in the county. They would come in and give assembly programs in our school. We would send some of our students into their school and do the same. Some of the churches in the community invited the Negro choirs in to sing. White speakers attended the Negro programs. When we reached the point of integration in 1956, our children had talked themselves out on this issue. You would raise it, and they weren't even interested. We felt that we were ready to integrate our school in 1956. When we opened school in August, we opened with some 12 Negro students and 800 whites. We had 3 days of school, no trouble whatsoever. Everyone seemed well satisfied. Nothing was said. At the end of these 3 days, the teachers had a period of 1 week for in-service training. During this 1 week's training, a citizen of the state of New Jersey took it upon himself to come into Clinton, Tennessee, John Casper by name. He immediately began circulating pamphlets of all kinds, very filthy pamphlets with many things on them that were objectionable. He started circulating among the people in the community and asked them if they were going to put up with having niggers, and that is the term he used. I do not use it myself in that term, in the schools with their children. He wanted to know what they were going to do about it. He announced that he was going to have mass meetings. So when we reopened school 1 week later, we found ourselves faced with pickets outside the school building, people jeering at students and teachers who entered the building. In spite of all this, we upheld our enrollment with about 25 students dropping out of school. But conditions grew increasingly worse at night. Mass meetings were held in the courthouse, with Casper being the main leader. He organized what he called the White Citizens Council, collecting $5 fee from all people who would join. And he got some 300 to 400 people to join this organization. They became increasingly violent. At night, they marched upon the houses of the mayor and had to be turned back by the police. They threatened to blow up the high school. They threatened to blow up my home. They threatened to kill me. As a matter of fact, on certain nights, the police in Clinton asked me to leave town because they said, we cannot protect you and control this mob at the same time. During all of this, inside the school itself, it was as peaceful as any place I have ever been in my life. And this can be attributed to by some 80 to 100 newspaper men who were on the scene. At the time we were trying to operate under an integrated situation, we had people outside picketing us and trying to cause trouble. We had all these newspaper reporters who were almost an army within themselves, quite frankly, wanting information of all kinds. But we were very happy that they should have the information, because we wanted the people of America to know what was going on that was good. Unfortunately, the headlines of your newspapers played up all the unpleasant incidences and played down many of the good incidences. At the end of 4 days, it became so violent that the mayor of our community had to ask the governor of the state for help. Clinton had a police force of some 7 or 8 men who were totally incapable of handling this crowd. Our governor, I'm very happy to say, took exactly the opposite stand from the governor of the state of Little Rock, from the state of Arkansas. I guess Arkansas will be known as Little Rock from now on. He sent in the Highway Patrol and the National Guard with one purpose. That was to protect the rights of every citizen in the schools of Clinton, Tennessee, and within the community itself. We had no troops within our building. We did not need troops in our building. He did protect these people, and within a week everything was settled down. We had arrested John Casper. We had tried him and convicted him, although it took some 18 months later before he was finally placed in jail. It was not until October of this year until he went to jail for the trouble that he caused last year. Now then, many people have asked me this. Why did you people decide to integrate your school? We as a faculty met and discussed this quite openly. We decided that we had certain responsibilities to our children. And we set down certain basic reasons, which are very simple and very fundamental in a democracy. They hardly bear repeating. But we felt that if we were to lead children, that we had to practice ourselves the tenets of a democratic nation. What were the things that we believed in? First, we believed fundamentally in the golden rule as it is stated in the Bible, that every person should be treated as he himself would like to be treated. We felt that the best way to teach democracy was by living democracy. We did not feel that we could teach our students in civics class that they should obey the laws of the country, and that we ourselves would flagrantly violate these same laws. We felt that every individual is a human being and has capabilities for developing. We felt that the white supremacy principle was very wrong. The world recently had a very strong illustration in the case of Hitler in Germany. We did not feel that we could stand behind any such course of action. And finally, we felt that the people in any given community will take the right course of action if they are given the proper leadership. And we accepted the responsibility of attempting to give these people such leadership. Now, what were some of the forces that were used against us? Threats of all kinds, as I've already mentioned. My telephone rang incessantly at night with anonymous telephone calls telling me many of the things that I've already mentioned. I received many threatening letters. I changed my telephone 4 times during the school year. Unlisted numbers each time, but some way they would always get a hold of those numbers, and at night it would just ring incessantly. It was almost impossible to sleep. I received hundreds and thousands of letters. I'm very happy to say that of those letters, which came from 37 different states, 13 foreign countries, and 1 Australian battleship, that up until January, when Edward R. Moore's film, See It Now, entitled Clinton, the Law, was shown, my mail was running 3-1 in favor of what we were doing. And this 3-1 mail was not all coming from the North. There were many people in the South who were supporting us, many newspapers in the South who were supporting us in what we were doing. Edward R. Moore's film had the greatest effect upon public opinion of anything I have ever known. After that film was shown, some of you may have seen it, which was strictly a documental film, my mail changed from 300-1 to 100-1 for what we were doing. To me, that was amazing. And most of our troubles stopped after that particular program. Other things that occurred. Parents were threatened. Their children were threatened. On one particular day, over a period of 24 hours, our enrollment dropped from 750 to 260 students. What had happened overnight? The White Citizens Council members had gotten on the telephone and had telephoned every parent that had a telephone who had a child in school and told him that the schoolhouse was to be blown up the next day. When I arrived at school, my telephone started ringing, her parents wanting to know if it was true. Well, of course, I didn't know whether it was true or not. I didn't know whether I was sitting on dynamite or whether I wasn't sitting on dynamite. And actually, they did set off some 10 or 12 dynamite blasts in the community. So I had some reason to be a little bit alarmed at these children in school. But anyway, we had people come in. We searched the building and the ground from top to bottom. The only thing we could tell these parents that they would have to use their own judgment. Within 5 days, our enrollment was back up to normal, back up to our 775 students. In the early days of the campaign, a particular incident occurred which I think is symbolic of the attitude of our children. John Casper and this crowd of people appeared on the school grounds one day and demanded that I come out and talk with them. I'm not a particularly brave person. I don't claim to be, but by this time, I was ready to talk to anybody to try to get to the heart of the trouble. As a matter of fact, I lost 20 pounds in a period of 10 days, and I didn't have much to lose to begin with. But anyway, I went out and talked to him in this crowd, and they immediately swallowed me up. And he said, "What are you going to do about getting the niggers," and again I use that term as he expressed it, "out of the school?" I asked him first what business it was of his. He had never lived in Tennessee. He was not a citizen of Tennessee. He had no children in the school. He had no stake in the community whatsoever. Well, he stated that he was just acting as an interested citizen in America, and that he felt this thing was wrong, and that he was the spokesman for these various people. And I want to say that of these 300 people, I did not recognize over five people that I had ever seen before in my life. They came down out of the mountains and from under the rocks and everywhere. But anyway, I told him that as we saw it, we had only three choices, or I had only three choices. One was to disobey the law, which I did not intend to do. Secondly, to resign my job, which I did not intend to do. Thirdly, to obey the law, which I told him was the thing that I intended to do. He then said, "Well," he said, "can't you see that all this great group of people here said they're against you? Said you just resign. They want you out." I told him, I said, "I just believe that the people in this school don't feel that way." I said, "I have some 775 students in here." I said, "I'm willing to put it up to these students and their parents. If they want me to resign, I'll do so. If they want us to obey the law, I'll stick with it." So I called an assembly meeting, the entire student body. We met, and I just told them the situation. I said, "Now, if I stay here, we're going to obey this law. If you feel that we shouldn't obey the law, I am willing to resign as of today." Myself and the teachers left the auditorium. They had their discussion, and they voted 100% to obey the laws of this country. I then came back and asked them to get a feeling of their parents on this matter, because I felt that the time had come that we had to really know where the people stood. And out of all the parents in the entire student program, we only had approximately 35 parents who felt that we should disobey the laws of the land. Now, this is a point I want to make. In a community that over 90% of, in which over 90% were opposed to integration, I don't think there's any question about it. They didn't want integration. But they were willing to abide by the laws of this country, and I think many of them were accepting the fact, and many of them have accepted the fact, that it is the right thing to do since that particular time. Well, anyway, because of the backing of these students and the backing of their parents, we felt that they were behind us. Another type of force that was used against us, they organized the Ku Klux Klan. They held meetings outside of town. They burnt crosses. They would get in their automobiles at night and drive through the Negro community blowing their horns as loud as they could, some 100 automobiles. And those first 2 weeks of school were indeed very hectic for the Negro population, because they were frightened, and I mean they were really frightened, because these mobs were forming at the courthouse. They would march up through the region where they lived. I have since found that many white people in the community of Clinton took these Negroes into their homes and kept them through these hectic nights of the early disturbances. I will point out two or three other courageous acts of individual citizens a few moments later. Now, these are some of the things that were used against us. Now, what weaknesses did we have that made our job more difficult than we would expect? One, the superintendent of our schools was doing everything he could to work against us. Although on the record, he had said you are to integrate. At night, he was meeting with other groups of citizens and organizing plans. And he actually came over to the school at one time and told me that if I wanted to, that I could get the Negroes out of the school. I asked him if that was an order. He said no. He said this is off the record. We had a divided school board. Some of the school board believed in upholding the law. Some were against it. Those members of the school board who were against it, like the superintendent, were working night and day in every way they could to make our job more difficult. And of course, as always, there are those politicians who are seeking political gain, people who wanted some minor office in the county, and so they jumped on the bandwagon of the segregationists and the White Citizens Council in the hope that they would get votes in running for election later. You will find out how this turned out in a few moments. They organized a newspaper, which they call the East Tennessee Reporter, which is as vicious as any paper I've ever seen. Any little incident that occurred in the school, they would take it and blow it up and build it completely out of proportion and full of falsehoods. In addition to that, as I say, we had a very inadequate police force which could not handle the situation. Now, what did we have to compensate for these particular weaknesses? First, we had wonderful morale in our faculty. We had decided together that we were going to see this thing through, and we did. Never at any time did any faculty member show any inclination that they would weaken in their stand. And they, too, had great pressures placed upon them. They were being called at night. They were receiving telephone calls and letters through the mail, the same as I was. I was particularly proud of our student body. I've mentioned the one big stand that they took. There are several other stands that they took along the line that helped us. Our football team, which can have a tremendous effect in morale, particularly in a southern school, as a group got together and decided that they were going to support what we were doing. And they actively did so in the student body. I remember one particular day when two Negro boys were returning to school from lunch and they were being followed with a crowd of some 100 people. And some of these people jumped these two boys, and it just happened that some of the football boys were sitting out on the lawn. And they dashed up the street a block away and rescued these two Negro boys from this crowd and brought them back to school. That had a tremendous effect upon the student body. We had strong support from our churches. Many of you are familiar with the action of one of the local ministers, who led these children off the hill one day and in return was beaten up by 7 white men. That was one of the great turning points in this struggle, because that particular day was an election day in Clinton. There was an election for the mayor and city council. The White Citizens Council had a group of candidates, and the existing people who favored obedience to law and order were running. The White Citizens Council was defeated 4-1 in this particular election. This was the day the minister was beaten up. This was the day we had to close school. Things had been rougher and rougher and rougher up to December the 4th. On this particular day, as I say, the minister was beaten up. 2 white people invaded the school, attempted to get Negro children out to do we did not know what. They ran over one of the teachers in the building. I decided that things had to come to a head. The police department was not giving us support. The school board was not giving us support. The county superintendent was not giving us support. And the federal government was not giving us support. So I closed the school down at noon that day because I really feared violence. And secondly, I wanted the school board to take one side of the fence and stay on it publicly. And I wanted the federal government to take one side of the fence and stay on it. After I closed down school, a group of the student council got together. They drew up a petition asking the school board that they reopen school and that they support the laws of this country and support integration of schools. The faculty did the same thing. As a result, the school board got together and decided they would not ride the fence any longer, that they would openly come out and stand with us, which they did from that point on. They in turn sent a telegram to Attorney General Brownell in Washington and pointed out the fact that we had been ordered by the courts of this country to open our doors to Negro students, and was the federal government going to do anything to help protect these students. Within 2 days, we received a telegram from Attorney General Brownell by way of Georgia, where the president happened to be at that time, as he is from time to time. Stating that we could expect help from the federal government. Within 24 hours, a number of FBI agents appeared in the community and started investigating everybody that it even looked like they wanted to make trouble. Boy, things got so quiet you could have dropped a pin in that old county. As a result of that investigation, some 16 white people were arrested. And later on in the summer of that year, they were tried, and six of them were convicted by a white jury, which I think is a very amazing thing. And as a result of the federal government getting behind us and the school board getting on the bandwagon, we reopened school in 3 days, and we had very little trouble from that point on. Now, these things gave us great strength and enabled us to go through many of our rough days. Now then, what is the significance of this Clinton story? I would like to tell you one other incident. There's so many things I could tell you, and I could go on and on and on. But one of the most heartening things that occurred on graduation day. We had one senior who was a Negro. There had never been a Negro student graduating a public school south of the Mason-Dixon line. And naturally, there was a great deal of interest in this particular situation because, unfortunately, this boy was not a very good student. And we honestly didn't know whether he was going to make it or not until about 2 weeks before the end of school. But we had agreed in the faculty that if he made it, he was going to graduate, and if he didn't make it, he was going to fail. It was going to be purely on a basis of what he did and upon no other basis. Well, we released our list of our graduating class about 2 weeks before the end of school, and his name was on it. Well, of course, immediately the newspapers and everyone descended upon us again. All the big TV networks wanted to set up their camera crews, and everyone else wanted to be in here, and people in the community were saying the boy would not graduate, that they'd kill him before he'd graduate. So we decided that we would ask the TV people and the motion picture people and the camera people to stay out of our auditorium. Well, of course, you can foresee the consequences of that. They all landed out upon us and told us we were trying to censor the press and we were suppressing information and so on and so forth. But anyway, we told them that they weren't going in the gymnasium, and we had people stationed on the doors to keep anyone from going in with a camera. Newsmen could go in and see what occurred, but we could just foresee all those cameramen in there and flash bulbs going on and someone would flare up and we would really have a big hullabaloo there. Well, anyway, graduation night came, and I became more nervous, and there it got. I went over that night before it was to occur, and here was this great crowd of photographers out there waiting for me. So they started arguing with me again about the thing. I just told them they weren't going in. They said, "Well, now, who says so? What legal authority do you have to keep us out?" I just told them, I said, "I don't know whether I have any legal authority or not, but I said, I've got the manpower over there that's going to keep you out." And I knew they didn't have time to get an injunction to keep me from doing it that night, and I wasn't worrying much further than the next day at that particular time. Well, this is the point I'm trying to get to. At that particular point, Bobby Kane, the Negro boy, drove up in his car outside the building. But we had discussed this with our entire class. They all understood the situation. Police photographers saw him, and they dashed down to get his picture. Well, a group of white boys standing nearby saw what was about to occur, so they beat the photographers to Bobby. And they asked him, they said, "Bobby, you want your picture made?" And he said, "No, man, I sure don't." So they just surrounded him. Those cameramen couldn't get to him, and they let him into the building. They didn't get his picture. Well, we had our graduation, some 1,500 people there in the gymnasium, smooth as anything I ever saw in my life. No trouble whatsoever. Well, it was all over, and I felt pretty good. I thought, boy, we really got through a tough one tonight. And I went over to where the seniors were dressing, and I found then that things had not been near as pleasant as they appeared. This group of photographers were still outside the building, and I went out and asked them if they were satisfied. They said, yes, that you treated us fairly, said no one got in. And they all turned and left except one fella who happened to be the photographer from this little old dirty paper in town, the East Tennessee Reporter, that had given us so much trouble. And he just stood there. And he said, Mr. Britton, said, what are you going to do about those terrible boys in your senior class? I said, well, I don't know what you're talking about. He said, put your hand on my shoulder. Well, I did, and he was just as wet as if he'd been in the river. I said, well, what happened to you, Leo? He said, oh, I said, it's those senior boys of yours up there. He said, I went up to the window and tried to take a picture through the window and said, you know what one of those boys did? He threw a gallon bucket of water in my face. He said, now I've got his picture right here in this camera if you want to do something about it. He says, we're going to find out what kind of a man you are. Well, it was all I could do to keep from laughing in his face. I said, Leo, I said, you know the unfortunate thing? Those boys just graduated 20 minutes ago.
I'm sure that a talk like that must lead to discussion. We have time allotted for it. Questions, discussion, comments. Floor is open for them. Yes, Jill.
Mr. Britton, I've just come back from a short trip in the South, and the impression I've had in Louisiana and Texas was that the situation in many other communities, particularly in Chicago, because of white citizens' council taking over the school board, for example, in Houston, I understand that the Negro supervisors can afford to resign and have accepted positions as principal. The impression I had, and I was curious to know whether yours was comparable, was whether or not the fact that so-called liberal public opinion has not seemed fit to voice its disapproval of what has taken place in the last, or since 54, as a result, some of the less pleasant members of the community, mob groups and others have taken over situations or organizations which were normally under control of responsible and respectable business leaders. In other words, intimidation is taking place pretty widely throughout most of the communities of the South, as far as I've been able to find out, and whereas in the past, liberal opinion might have expressed itself and had something to say about the way the schools were being run and the way the whole desegregation program was being the two have been silenced by intimidation and blackmail. Is that something you experienced?
I would say that the Southern educator is caught in the jaws of a vice. Here he is a professional person. He has professional views. But it is very difficult for him to openly say what he believes. For instance, at no time during this integration trouble did I publicly state that I believed in integration. What did I say? I said we shall obey the laws of this land. Because if you openly come out and take sides, you're going to get snowed under. Now that's what the Southern educator is faced with. Now this is what is occurring in the South. What you speak of is very, very true. But the communities that have had the experience that we have had, and Nashville has had the same thing, the mere violence of these attacks have been defeating the segregationist cause. Because people say, well, we would rather have integration as have to put up with being run by this particular group of people. For instance, John Casper would have to search far and wide when he gets out of jail, in my opinion, to find anybody who will follow him now in the South. The most ardent segregationists, such as Senator Eastland of Mississippi, disavows that he wants anything to do with John Casper. So what is happening? They're going underground. And as you say, they are attempting to get control of these things. Now, it's going to be a long, hard fight. I think anyone that would estimate as to when Mississippi or Louisiana or Georgia or South Carolina is going to integrate would be foolish. I don't think there's anything you can base it upon. I think on the border states, you are going to see gradual compliance with the law. I will say, however, that this Little Rock situation, sending in of federal troops to Little Rock, has caused tremendous repercussions in the South. Now you say, well, what else could the president have done? And it's easy to backseat guess, and I certainly have no desire to try to outguess the president of the United States. But when he publicly stated that he would never send troops into a state to enforce integration, and then when he some months later did that very thing, he antagonized tremendous forces in the South. Now, is there anything else he could have done? He could have done what he is now doing, and I'm not second-guessing the president. He probably sees this himself now. He could have taken over the National Guard in Arkansas and federalized the National Guard and used them instead of sending his crack paratroop troops in there. Now, I think that is a great mistake, and I think the South is going to be a long time getting over that. That's a roundabout way. I'm not sure I answered your question. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I would like to make a generalization, and it is purely a generalization. Mm-hmm. I think Dr. Carmichael in Louisville has done the most outstanding job in integration in the United States today. Now, what did he do that we didn't do, that we could have profited by? He did one very significant thing, maybe many things. We held meetings, community meetings, PTA meetings. We met in every community where we had children coming in. We assumed that interested people would attend these meetings. That's where we made our great mistake. The people that John Casper got to follow him were the people that never attended any of these meetings. What did Dr. Carmichael do in Louisville? He organized it, and they made a house-to-house canvas of the entire city, not just the people who had children in school, but everybody in the community was informed as to what was to occur. And I'd say that's wonderful. They took in all Negro students that were eligible. We took in all, although it was a very small number. Little Rock attempted to take a select few. Now, they did some preparation, and I think they were as near ready as we were. And that's not saying a whole lot, as things turned out. And yet, as I look at it, to live through that year as we did last year and come out on top is a pretty good accomplishment within itself. But I think Little Rock would not have had trouble if Governor Faubus had not have done what he did. Now, that's the thing that set off the Little Rock controversy. But I think adequate preparation is absolutely essential. I think everybody, regardless of whether they have children in school or who they may be, should be kept fully informed and should be involved in the situation as much as possible. What you're saying, and I agree with you 100%, that the more channels of communication that can be kept open between people, the better chance you've got of understanding. And that's what he did. He did a magnificent job. Yes, sir.
As I listen to your story, and personal reflections on a Clinton episode, you made one statement which I would like, with your permission, to suggest that when you have occasion to refer to it again, don't go over it so hastily, but rather emphasize it. The statement was the following, and I almost quote, "How could we teach civics to children in a school when the adults and the responsible citizens refuse to obey the laws of the land?" Now, we have had, not only in Clinton, but throughout the country, a significant increase in disobedience for the law, particularly among the youth of our nation. And I've been silently, somewhat impatiently waiting to hear an educator make that statement that you made tonight. Because as the press reports it to us, educators, jurists, politicians, and many other responsible people apparently concerned very sincerely with the problem of juvenile delinquency have not attempted to see the simplest formulation, and that is this: when there is a gross neglect for the rights of others on a local, national, and perhaps international scheme, how can we expect the restless teenagers to be more obedient to the rights and dignities of man than a grown-up?
I could have spoken to that to a great extent. There are many incidences we had in our school of children coming in and talking with me. My door was open at all times, and again, this is not a personal illustration, but I think it is very significant. And even some 25 or 30 kids who finally did give us some trouble in school would come in and sit down with me and talk to me about this thing in the office. And I had several boys that told me they had been offered as much as $50 to start a fight in school by adult people in the community. They would not give me the names of the people concerned. We had more juvenile delinquency in Clinton in that one year than we have had in the whole history of the school in the 20 years that I was there. And who were the kids that were involved? The ones that were tied up with these white segregationist people. They got involved in stealing automobiles, they got involved in the breaking into houses, and so on and so forth, which I think is a very fine point that you've made there, sir.
Could you talk about what is happening in Clinton this year?
As far as integration is concerned, they have had no trouble except one little incident. And that involved this. When John Casper was causing his trouble in Nashville, before he actually went to jail, and at the time Little Rock was so much in the headlines, he came through Clinton one night and had a bunch of circulars that he had distributed among some of the kids and have them give out in the school, saying, "We're going to support Little Rock. We're all going to get up and walk out at 10 o'clock in the morning." Well, 10 o'clock in the morning occurred, and three students got up and walked out, and the principal immediately expelled them from school, and that was the end of that. And as far as integration is concerned, they have not had any problems. Now, they have been having other problems, which are a result of the very thing that you mentioned back here. They're having discipline problems this year, which we did not have much of last year. Now, there's a lot of things involved in that which I would rather not go into. I can speak to that point, and again, these are opinions, some of them. As far as laws are concerned, in 11 states in the South now, over 23 different laws have been passed to attempt to get around this thing. But I can give you a very, and I'm just as confident as I am of anything, that when these things go to court, they're going to be thrown out. And I think these people are sure of it, too. They're fighting a delaying action. There's an illustration in Tennessee at the time we had our trouble. They had 7 laws on their statute books at that time, all of which were used against us and all of which were thrown out of court. They were just unconstitutional, that's all. And all of these things are going to be unconstitutional. Now then, as for things being worse, I would say that there is a greater fear among people in the South about this thing because of the disturbances which have occurred in places like Clinton and Mansfield, Texas, and Sturgis and Clay, Kentucky, and Little Rock. People say, oh, we'd want this thing to happen here. And of course, the segregationists can say, see, it's what we told you, that when the Negroes came into the school, this was going to occur. Well, who's causing the trouble? That's what I would ask. Is it the Negroes, or is it the white segregationists that are causing the trouble? Now, as I see this thing, look at how much progress was made in the South and from the end of the Civil War until 1954 when the decision was made. Not one dent was made in the solid South. Have some dents been put in there since the decision? Yes, sir, they have. I think any progress, any great social progress, that all those great traditions that occur, you're going to get some violence. I think this thing is natural. And it kind of goes in spurts. You go forward a little bit, sit, reconsolidate, then you go forward a little bit more. Now, again, I wouldn't say when. And, of course, as to whether conditions are worse or not is dependent upon what angle you're looking at them from. Some ways it is. But on the other hand, I don't think the South would ever integrate voluntarily. And I think the facts support that, because no integration took place in the South until the Supreme Court made its decision. But there have been, there are over 800 and some odd school districts now desegregated in the South. That's a good question, and I would speak to that. It is said, and I've heard very responsible people make this comment, as an illustration, Atlanta, Georgia, that if it were put up to the people of Atlanta themselves, that they would vote for school integration, for the economic cost of operating a dual school system and for other reasons. And I know in my own instance in Knoxville, Tennessee, which is rather industrial, that we got great support from those people over there. As a whole, they were supporting what we were doing. And I think that is probably true, that the industrial regions will come sooner. Now, something else is happening. We say no progress is being made. These southern states are building the finest Negro schools you ever saw just as fast as they can get them constructed. Now, I think this is essential in the South. I think, and this is opinion, but I think there's some statistics that will support it, that at the present time, the majority of the Negroes are on a lower educational level than the whites because of inadequate school systems. Now, I think if they want to make this thing work, they need to be able to do the work on the scholastic level with the whites. How's the best way for them to do it? To improve their own schools. Then when they do integrate, they'll be better able to do it. For instance, out of the 12 students we had, there were only 4 of them that made passing grades, and they received very fair treatment. Of course, there's something else. They had great pressures upon them. Nobody can foresee how great that affected those children. All this business of having come to school through this feeling of hate that surrounded them when they went home at night, not knowing what was going to happen to them. I know how they feel from personal experience. And I wouldn't want to judge those kids on the basis of what they did that one year, last year.
I know it's hard to generalize, but what about the prevailing spirit among the white teachers with regard to this whole thing? Is there, are they ready to move when they have the leadership?
Well, I think the feeling, of course, among the white teachers, I can only speak for our school and the people that I've talked to. The white teacher is up against this tremendous thing. He's ready to move when he feels his community is ready to move with him. He can't move before the people are ready to go. Now, I think our case is a partial illustration of that. Now, you say, well, the people will never get ready to go. But I think it can come about. And I think unless a man's willing to really get out on the end of a limb and have it sought out with him, out from under him, that he better give consideration to that fact. And that's not true of me. They didn't sort out from under me.
What about the integration of the Negro white students in the parent-teacher
association?
Well, we had complete integration on that. As soon as we opened our doors of our school, perhaps it should have come sooner. It occurred before in that, myself, I visited with all the PTAs and other people in the school system did the same thing. And as soon as we opened our doors to the students, we opened our doors to the parents, and they attended much, much higher percentage, of course, than the white parents did, and there was no reaction on that at all. They were welcomed in and accepted in the parent-teachers' meeting. I just don't know what has occurred in other communities, but I assume in Louisville that it's true, and maybe in most of the communities where it's Tom. Yes, sir.
I'd like to inquire whether if among the faculty and many of the principals there was anywhere near the unanimity in the principals that segregation was inherently evil, where did the danger lie to those who led rather than followed the community if they had all expressed themselves?
Well, of course, the danger is the pressures of the unscrupulous pressures that are placed upon you. Anything you would say or do would be twisted around and turned against you. I was accused of everything that anybody could be humanly accused of being a drunkard, of being a dope fiend, of being a communist, and anything else that anyone could drag in. Well, now, maybe they had good justification for it, because I'll admit I look like walking death. As an illustration, I got down to 115 pounds, and I weigh 155 now. So I could see why maybe they had the right to think that. And I'll admit that I was pretty well numb. I might as well have been doped in some ways. But they can bring tremendous pressures on you, and what have you got to uphold you? You've got the fact that you think you're right, and a few people who will openly stand by you, and those few people who openly stand up for you get themselves into trouble too. One of the most embarrassing things of the whole thing, I had 7 or 8 very good friends, influential people, this pastor of the Baptist Church, editor of the local newspaper, the respectable one as I call it, and other people who stood up for me, and every one of those people suffered very serious things of one sort or another, such as a beating. The minister got beat up, and one of the lawyers who came in and gave me his services for nothing, they caught him out on the country road and beat him across the face with a tire tube. The editor of the paper, they set dynamite off in his front yard. The other lawyer who helped me, who had a wife that taught in school, they burned the cross in front of his house. And those kind of things happened. And some way, none of it happened to me specifically. Actually, I'd have welcomed perhaps getting beat up. I'd have felt a little more honorable among my friends.
Governor Forbes has announced his intention of running for governor again at the next election. And as much as we're going to have a Democratic sweep here in this country,
I think he'll be reelected. I think that's the reason he's done everything he has done, for purely political reasons. I don't think Governor Forbes has any personal feelings about the matter. He sends his son to an integrated school. These are opinions. Now, I don't want to be quoted in the paper on what I'm saying.
I am seeking your opinion. Not so long ago, there was an incident in North Carolina. This time it involved a slightly different pigment. And I'm curious, because I lived in the South for 5 years during the war, and you confirmed it with much richer experience, that perhaps the majority of the people of the South would like, essentially, to be as decent as people anywhere in the world. But that it takes a few loud rebel rousers to whip up certain sentiments. But we discovered in North Carolina that descendants of the original Americans don't get frightened so easily, And so they retaliated, and my own personal impression as I read the headlines is that just the opposite occurred. Some of the Ku Klux Klan people got frightened and perhaps shot up a bit too, and some were even convicted since in a court. Now the question is this, it's for your opinion. Were we to arrive in the near future, as I hope we shall, where the Negro in the South does not get frightened as he had been and still continues to be as easily when a Castro and others come along, but reacts a little more aggressively, would the majority of the people accept it as a very normal, decent reaction, or would that tend to tip the scales in an unfavorable direction?
That's a very good question. I think what happened in North Carolina was wonderful, and practically everyone that I've talked with in the South, and I have been home since then, feels the same way about it. But you must remember that the Indian is in a minority, and here he rose up and smote these people down. Now, one of the great things that the people in the South are afraid of is the fact that there are so many Negroes that this sort of thing is what will occur, that they'll rise up and take over the country. The South cannot forget the carpet bag days following the Civil War. Now, I think Reverend King in Montgomery, Alabama, has stated the situation for the Negroes as to their best approach, that they've got to take it, and yet they've got to stand up, become intelligent, become voting citizens, and use their power in that way rather than fighting fire with fire, as happy as many of us were if that had occurred. Because if a group of Negroes, say, did do such a thing, I'm afraid the opinion would swing the other way, because that is one of the great fears in the South. That's just my opinion again. Well, actually, there are no elementary pupils attending school in Anderson County. This court order applied only to high school, and we had a high school from 9 to 12. The Negroes had good schools in Anderson County for their students. The reason I think they brought this test case, I didn't explain this against us, is that there were only approximately 12 high school Negro students in the county. Anderson County could not afford to build a high school for 12 people, so they were transporting these students to another school outside the county, which gave them a beautiful legal loophole, you see, to get into us on this particular case. Now, Nashville has started a different plan, and it will be interesting to see how it works. Now, there are various plans offered. Their plan is that they will start with the first grade, which they have done this year, and integrate the first grade, and that they will then move up as time goes by. Now, of course, Louisville integrated the whole pack and passel together. Quite frankly, I'm of the opinion that you just as well get the whole thing done at one time and get it over with. You're going to have trouble, I don't care how or when you do it. And it seems to me like you're going to either get it all at once or you're going to spread it over a long period of time. Now, I may be wrong about that, and Nashville, I think, will show us what is true. Now, as far as changing curriculum is concerned, we did nothing. We were fighting for our very existence and for our life. And we could not publicly say, now we're going to change our curriculum in any particular way. Now, we had already done this in regard to all of our students, as most schools are doing now, in that we grouped